September of 2018, I went home to visit my grandmother. And Grandma had a recliner that sat right next to her bed.
This is Stacey Abrams in the new documentary film, All In, The Fight for Democracy.
When you go to visit my grandma, you sat down because you did not want to interrupt whatever it was she was watching. And so I sat on the bedside waiting for her attention, and she turned to me. And unprompted, my grandmother reached for my hand and she started telling me about the first time she voted. It was 3 years after the adoption of the Voting Rights Act, but it was the first time for most African Americans that they really would have a chance to participate in an election. And this was during a time where you put on your Sunday best and you would make an event out of going to vote.
Abrams is a voting rights activist and a former state representative in Georgia. You probably heard of her when she ran for governor there in 2018. Her race got a lot of attention for a few reasons. She would have been the first African-American woman governor in U.S. history, but also for how close it was. She lost to Republican Brian Kemp by less than 55,000 votes. And the race was controversial because Kemp, who was Secretary of State at the time he ran, had purged some tens of thousands of voters from the rolls in the months leading up to that election. It's a point Abrams made when she spoke to supporters after the results became official.
I acknowledge that former Secretary of State Brian Kemp will be certified as the victor in the 2018 gubernatorial election. But to watch an elected official who claims to represent the people in this state baldly pin his hopes for election on the suppression of the people's democratic right to vote has been truly appalling. So let's be clear. This is not a speech of concession, because concession means to acknowledge an action is right, true, or proper. As a woman of conscience and faith, I cannot concede that.
Abrams says in the film, voting rights are personal for her. Her parents, her grandparents were involved in the civil rights struggle, which really almost as much as anything was a struggle to be able to cast a vote.
My grandfather called for her from the front room. Her name was Wilter. He's like, Wilter, come on. She didn't respond. Her nickname was Bill. And so then he yelled out, Bill, it's time to go. My grandmother said she still didn't say anything. So he came back to find out why she hadn't responded. And she was frozen. She was afraid to go. And I remember her squeezing my hand and the feel of that paper-thin skin and the fragile bones, but the grip that she had on my hand where she said that it wasn't that she didn't want to vote, she was afraid of it. She was afraid of the billy clubs and the hoses and the dogs, and she did not believe that this time would be any different. She didn't believe that the power of democracy was finally hers. My grandfather told her that she had to get up, that her children had been in trouble trying to guarantee this right, and that she owed it to them, if not to herself, to get up and vote. And she said she was still terrified, she was still deeply afraid of this moment, but she was also ashamed of herself. She was ashamed that she didn't want to reach for this power. She got up, she finished getting dressed, and they went to vote. And as she squeezed my hand, she said, but Stacey, I've never missed another election.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of voting rights in this country, which has always gone hand in hand with voter suppression. The film we're going to be screening next week as part of our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center, is about the past and present of these efforts to keep people from voting. Like women, like people of color. It's called All In, The Fight for Democracy. Our guest for the hour is Ari Berman. He's a senior reporter for Mother Jones, and he's featured throughout the film, which points out that this playbook of trying to keep people from voting is as old as the nation. So there used to be literacy tests and poll taxes and violence. These days you have strict voter ID laws and voter purges and gerrymandering. Different, but the idea is the same. And Ari Berman told us that in the early days of the American experience, as far as voting was concerned, it really wasn't anything like a democracy.
In the early days of the American Republic, only white male property owners could vote in most states. That meant that white men who didn't own property, which was most white men, were excluded from voting. That meant that women were excluded from voting. That meant that African Americans, many of whom were enslaved, were prevented from voting. That meant that Native Americans who weren't even considered citizens were not allowed to vote. So in the first presidential election, when George Washington was elected, only 6% of Americans were even eligible to vote. And so it was not a democracy in any sense of the way we think of democracy now, in that the vast majority of Americans were prevented from voting.
What does that tell you? What do you make of that, just in terms of what was the intent of the founders, in terms of the way this system was supposed to work, and what kind of access they thought people should have to voting or anything like that?
Well, the founders had seemingly contradictory views about how they viewed government. On the one hand, there's this very lofty language in the Declaration of Independence and in other places talking about government of, for, and by the people, right? But the founders really didn't want the people to rule in any sense of the word. They wanted government for people like them. They were afraid of the lower classes. They were afraid of people of different races. And they really wanted a educated white male intelligentsia to rule. And so they had more dramatic notions of democracy than Britain, for example. But they had much more limited notions of democracy than we think of today.
When does that start to change?
In the early 1800s, white men without property start getting restless. And you start hearing more about taxation without representation. Yeah. And so, for example, when Andrew Jackson is elected in the mid-1920s, you start seeing white men without property becoming able to vote in a number of states. But you don't really see a huge expansion of democracy to other groups until after the Civil War, when black men are given the right to vote through the 14th and most notably the 15th Amendment, and then the Reconstruction Acts that are passed in the former slave states. And then you see a huge expansion of democracy where 4 million black men are now eligible to vote. And you actually have black governors and senators from states like Louisiana and Mississippi, which we've never had since then in our country's history. And it's this remarkable period of integrated multiracial government in our country, but it only lasts for a very, very brief time until Reconstruction is violently overthrown and we get Jim Crow for nearly 100 years.
Do you have a sense that there was this brief moment where there was a real opportunity that maybe we could, maybe we could live up to our creed. There was a real window here of this might work, or did it always seem destined to fail, given the fact that there's a lot of racism in this country?
No, I mean, it really did seem like for a time that it would succeed. I mean, in such a short period of time, the Congress was able to pass and ratify the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment that completely changed American democracy, completely transformed American democracy, that gave people rights that were unthinkable when the Constitution was first ratified. And you had not just black government, you had integrated government in the southern states, where whites from the north and some from the south were joining forces with newly enfranchised African Americans and writing these really incredible state constitutions. And so it really felt like that could become in many ways the new normal, and that there would be a shared interest between whites and blacks. Now, it didn't last. What happens was that whites almost uniformly, instead of allying with African Americans, decided they wanted to overthrow them. And in the South, the white minorities, because whites were actually the minority in places like Mississippi, they basically overthrew majority black governments in places like Mississippi. And then the federal government essentially turned its back on Reconstruction and enforcing civil rights. And the Democrats back then were always the segregationist party. Republicans were supposed to be the party of civil rights, but the Republican Party of the North basically turned its back on black voting rights because they both wanted to court white votes, and they also wanted to move on to other issues instead of civil rights. And so basically, African Americans were abandoned by both Democrats and Republicans and left to fend for themselves for nearly 100 years during Jim Crow.
One thing you say in the film, Ari Berman, is that the greatest moments of progress in this country are always followed by this intense period of retrenchment. And I wanted to get you to say a little bit more about that. Like, why you think it is? Is it like there's a cycle here? And what is it about that? What do you understand about that cycle that you can help explain it?
I actually think it's really tangible, which is that the vote is about power. And so when one previously disenfranchised or marginalized group gains power, other people feel like they have lost power. And that's what happened after Reconstruction. When black men got the right to vote, white men felt threatened by that. Now, some white men decided to ally with African Americans, but most white men, particularly in the South, did not. And so the most intense periods of retrenchment follow the most intense periods of progress, because progress for one group feels like a complete elimination of progress for the other.
Let's talk a little bit more about this period of retrenchment in the South after Reconstruction begins to break down. How is it that Southern leaders are trying to keep black people from voting without, as I think Carol Anderson says in the film, without actually writing a law that says specifically black people cannot vote? Talk about the kind of sense of creativity and audacity that they come up with for these laws.
There's a mixture of both incredible creativity and also just brute violence and force. So on the one hand, there's a lot of brute violence. I mean, white people start killing black people. I mean, literally, they start lynching people. They start attacking African Americans at the polls. They start massacring them before Election Day. And so people are afraid to vote at all. So before we even see legal forms of disenfranchisement, we start to see many illegal forms of violence that the federal government is too cowardly to stop or enforce. Then once they've kind of scared away blacks from going to the polls because of violence, they start putting in all of these devices like the literacy test and the poll tax. So for example, they have a section of the Mississippi Constitution that says you have to be able to interpret the Constitution to be able to vote. Well, that's an entirely subjective thing that of course never mentions to race. But every white local registrar in Mississippi knew that they were going to disqualify any African American, no matter how educated they were, how great that they could interpret the Constitution. And they were going to allow basically any illiterate white person who had no idea what the Constitution said, but they were white, so that's all that mattered. So there were a lot of things like that that never mentioned race, but were intended to be enforced in a racially discriminatory way. That made it difficult to challenge it under the 15th Amendment, because they could say, well, we're not being racist here. We're just purging the government of illiterates and uninformed people.
It's interesting, these literacy tests, you have those that make an effort to try to seem legitimate, these tests. But then there were the ones that I've heard of, for example, the question, how many bubbles fit into a bar of soap, or other kind of ludicrous questions that people are being asked at polling stations. There was a lot of that too, I guess.
There was a lot of that too. There's an infamous literacy test from Louisiana where you have to spell letters backwards and circle different combinations of letters, and it's impossible to do. I mean, you would have to have a PhD in linguistics to even try to attempt to fill out this constitution. And of course, whites were never asked these questions. So it's all about creating all this unbelievable fortress of suppression, where if somehow you passed one test, you were certain to fail another. And it was all set up to make sure that African Americans never even registered to vote, let alone voted.
There's the Mississippi Plan. The film talks a little bit about that. And then there are these black codes as well. Do you want to say something about those? Because those are another element that just complicates the story.
Yeah, the black codes are basically forms of both economic and criminal intimidation. And so they're taking away rights from African Americans, and they're also creating this whole infrastructure, basically what becomes mass incarceration. So all of these new laws that, for example, you can that could become a felony. So then they make it like in Florida, well, they drastically expand what can be considered a felony. So there's things like vagrancy can now become a felony, which just like the literacy tests are incredibly subjective. Are you going to arrest someone who's standing around waiting for work? And then if you get a felony, they make it so that you can't vote. And so you start to see a lot of that too. So it's everything. It's all of the, it's an all of the above strategy. It's voter suppression. It's economic intimidation. It's the criminalization of basically being black. I mean, all of those things contribute to Jim Crow lasting for such a long time.
You mentioned in the film how basically overnight the rights of Americans to vote, that was just taken away overnight, basically. And you say that African Americans are eliminated from the electorate for the most part. And I wanted to know, what exactly does that mean in terms of voter participation? What do we know about the way before all of this took place that African Americans were voting compared to after these literacy tests came up and poll taxes and intimidation and violence?
It's really staggering. You go from 80% of African Americans participating in Mississippi to only 2% even being eligible to participate. I mean, we've never seen anything like it in our country's history, where rights were expanded so quickly to so many people and then so dramatically taken away. And white participation starts to fall as well, because there is some collateral damage here. There are some poor whites that can't afford to pay the poll tax, or may get kicked off for a literacy test if, in fact, upper class whites view lower class whites as a threat. So political participation in general basically starts lowering dramatically for blacks, but overall for whites as well. You see very, very low levels of participation in southern states. And then you also see the Republican Party basically disappear as an entity in the South. And you have an all white segregationist Democratic Party. And basically, the only thing that matters are primary contests. And you have candidates running to out segregation the other. And so the entire politics of the South are warped, where essentially the only contest is how much of a segregationist can you be? And those people that are the most extreme segregationists are usually the ones that win, the George Wallace types in Alabama. And the South is basically a one-party state in which an entire race is disenfranchised from roughly 1890 until 1965 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
The film talks about the D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation in 1915, which seemed to express a particular sentiment of the time. This is when the Ku Klux Klan starts to really emerge or reemerge. A lot of intimidation, a lot of violence around this. What's happening here? This is when violence again starts to sort of take hold.
Exactly. And that's one thing that I've been really interested in researching Reconstruction. I didn't even know this, that there was the first Ku Klux Klan, which existed during Reconstruction. The federal government cracked down on it very aggressively in the 1870s. They passed a Ku Klux Klan Act. The Klan basically disappeared and then was resurrected by D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which is widely considered to be the most influential film of all time, really the first major epic film, but an incredibly racist film that shows the majority black legislature in South Carolina with all of these racial stereotypes. They're eating watermelon. They're drinking whiskey. They're not wearing any shoes. They try to rape white women. And then when they go vote, they try to essentially despoil the ballot box. And the Ku Klux Klan shows up and they prevent blacks from voting. And the South is redeemed. Yeah. That is the narrative of the film. And that basically resurrected the Ku Klux Klan, and not just a Southern Ku Klux Klan, but a Northern Ku Klux Klan that was actually based in Indiana and had offices in Washington, D.C., and was far more respectable than the Southern Klan. And when Birth of a Nation was shown across the country, ushers in the North actually dressed as Klan members for the screening. So, I mean, it's just appalling what is happening in America in the 1910s and the 1920s when Jim Crow is really being intensified largely through the use of popular culture. And the fact that this wasn't just a Southern thing, but it was also being embraced by many in the North. It's a history that a lot of us are not taught in school, that a lot of people don't know about. Even the discussion of Birth of a Nation for many years, I had never seen the film until recently. For many years, I just knew it was considered this great film. And it was only when I watched it that I realized how truly racist it was and how disturbing it was that this is considered the birth of modern cinema, because it really is a really disturbing film that had a huge impact on society.
Well, there's this narrative in the film that I wanted to ask you about, this idea that during Reconstruction, when there were African-American governors and African-American senators, that they were corrupt, that they were immoral. Was that a sentiment you saw a lot of? And maybe speak to that. What do we know about the effectiveness of African American, you know, legislators and governors? That is a contrast to that narrative.
That was absolutely a narrative that was embraced not just in the South, but among many whites in the North. That blacks were illiterate, that blacks were corrupt, that they had no business running the government, that you could not entrust the government to these kind of people. In fact, it was a largely false narrative. In many of these states, the black governments did a lot of good. They established public schools. They rebuilt their states after they had been destroyed during the Civil War. They built new hospitals. They built new roads. They built new schools. These were things that benefited not just African Americans, but whites. They also were really never in charge of states in the way that it makes it seem. I think South Carolina was the only state that had a majority black legislature. So Mississippi had some very influential African Americans. Mississippi had black senators and black congressmen and a black speaker of the House. But blacks never controlled the states. The state always had a white governor. The state always had a white-dominated legislature. And so, first off, it was just factually inaccurate to say that blacks controlled the states and disenfranchised all whites, because whites remained as part of the government in all of these Southern states. But secondly, these legislatures and these states where African Americans had influence did a tremendous amount of good, far more good than the segregationists that ran the states beforehand had done. And there was no more corruption in South Carolina than there was in Indiana or Illinois. But the Northern press wasn't covering what was happening in the North. They were covering what was happening in the South because they wanted to create a political message. And so they seized on these allegations of fraud, no matter how debunked they were, to try to make it seem like African Americans couldn't be trusted to run the government, and therefore any means were necessary to overthrow them.
When do African Americans really start to try and reassert their rights to vote? There's this really terrible story of a World War II vet told in the film. Maciel Snipes, African American man, comes home to Georgia, is determined to vote. Talk a little bit about this particular story, as it just maybe expresses a larger theme here, where you have African Americans who served their country, who feel like it's time for them to be able to assert their American rights.
Yeah, I mean, you have people that go abroad and are fighting for freedom, and then they come home and they're unable to vote, that they are lynched when they try to participate. And Maceo Snipes was one of those people who, in July 1946, he voted in the Georgia Democratic primary. He was the first African-American to vote in his county. He knew that that was a very dangerous thing, even though the Supreme Court had outlawed all-white primaries in 1944. And a day after he voted, the Ku Klux Klan went to his farmhouse and they shot him in the back. And it was a murder. It was an execution, just like so many African-Americans were murdered during that time, and we don't even know their names. And so this is someone who fights abroad for his freedom and then comes back home and is murdered for exercising that freedom. And there is a slow amount of progress in the 40s and 50s, but it really isn't until the Civil Rights Movement kicks off that you begin to see a full campaign to try to get all different rights, but most importantly, to get voting rights, because the civil rights movement realizes that if they get the right to vote, it's going to be a lot easier to achieve all the other rights that they're fighting for as well.
Say more about the connection between civil rights and the right to vote. It seems like that – I mean, there was a lot that was going on that was fueling the civil rights movement, but it seems principally inspired by that basic right to vote, it seems.
The first major speech that Martin Luther King gives about voting rights is in 1957. It's called Give Us the Ballot. It inspired the title of my book. And King gives this speech – on the third anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education in May of 1957. And he is asking the question, how is it that 3 years after the Brown versus Board of Education decision is supposed to desegregate public schools, not a single school in the South has been desegregated? And what he says is it's because the South is still controlled by white Southern segregationists that are not going to do anything to desegregate the schools or promote any other civil rights as long as only whites have the right to vote and African Americans are disenfranchised. And so King, who's only 28 years old at the time, gives this speech called Give Us the Ballot, because he says, give us the ballot and we'll never have to worry the federal government about any of our other rights. We'll have the power to control our destiny. Mm-hmm. But as long as we don't have those rights, we're not going to be able to get all of these other rights. And so they start steadily building a movement for all sorts of civil rights. I mean, it really begins with the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. Then you have the sit-in movement in 1960, and then you have the freedom rides in 1961, and then you have the March on Washington in 1963. But it's all building towards winning the right to vote in 1965 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So African Americans can start to elect their own mayors, their own city council members, their own county commissioners. They can start to elect progressive whites to replace the likes of George Wallace in Alabama. And only then are things going to start to change both in the South and in the country writ large.
What happens on the Edmund Pettus Bridge? Not just what happens. I mean, we know what happens. We know that local officials, that Sheriff Clark went after peaceful protesters trying to march for their rights. But you talk in the film about how this really this kind of nationwide movement for voting rights erupts that week. It seems like it was a critical time in this story.
The march that John Lewis led on the Edmund Pettus Bridge changed the whole arc of American history, because John Lewis's group, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had been in Selma, Alabama, where only 2% of African Americans are registered to vote, for 2 years. And they basically, since 1963, and they basically hadn't been able to get anyone registered, because the local officials were so segregationist, they ran such a tight ship, and the federal government didn't care, wasn't intervening. And so what happened when John Lewis and 800 other marchers were brutally beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, it changed the consciousness of the nation in a way that no other march had. That night, ABC News broke into its primetime premiere of Judgment at Nuremberg, a film about Nazi Germany, to show the images from Selma, Alabama, of police spraying tear gas and beating civil rights demonstrators on horseback and clubbing people like John Lewis and women and mothers who were totally defenseless. Many Americans actually thought the images from Selma were from Nazi Germany.
Wow.
And people just reacted with shock and fury in a way that they never had before. The march on Selma and Bloody Sunday, it just resonated in a way that no other march had. And Lyndon Johnson and others knew that they couldn't waste any time, that they had to act, or things were really going to spiral out of control. And so 8 days after that march, Lyndon Johnson introduces the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and gives this incredible speech in which he says, there is no black versus white problem. There is no Democrat versus Republican problem. There is no North versus South problem. There's only an American problem. And he actually uses the words, we shall overcome, which is the rallying cry of the civil rights movement. And John Lewis watched that speech with Martin Luther King in Selma, in the house of a local dentist. And he said it was the only time in his life he ever saw Martin Luther King cry. And so it was an incredibly powerful moment for this country. But a lot of things had to go right. You had to have a committed civil rights movement. You had to have an event that changed and shocked the consciousness of the country. And you had to have both a president and a Congress that were agile enough and committed enough to civil rights to act on it. Remember, Lyndon Johnson had just won a landslide victory in 1964. There was a huge Democratic majority in Congress. So all the conditions lined up to pass the Voting Rights Act. If any one of those things had been different, there might not have ever been a Voting Rights Act of 1965.
We have to talk about William Rehnquist. I have to say, I did not know this part of the story. And it's a part of the story that you tell in the film, that William Rehnquist, long before he becomes Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, is, as you tell it in the film, and I want you to sort of take us through this, he's responsible for ballot security operations for the Republican Party of Maricopa County in Arizona. Take it from there, if you would, because this is a remarkable story.
Yeah, so William Rehnquist is an ally of Barry Goldwater, the Republican nominee for president in 1964, who was really the first Republican to run on a platform of opposition to civil rights. Before that, Republicans had been the party of civil rights, but Goldwater opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was a huge turning point for his party. And Rehnquist worked for Goldwater, and then he led ballot security operations in Maricopa County, Arizona, home to Phoenix, the largest county in the state. What Rehnquist did is he actually went and essentially gave literacy tests to Black and Hispanic voters who were in line to vote and asked them to read portions of the Constitution, essentially giving the Mississippi Plan of 1890 to Black and Latino voters in Arizona in the 1960s. This was called Operation Eagle Eye. And so Rehnquist essentially gets his political career started through voter suppression and then is elevated eventually to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And it really goes to show you how far right the Supreme Court has moved. And then, of course, a number of people clerk for Rehnquist and take on his opposition to voting rights, one of whom is John Roberts, yeah, who eventually replaces him as Chief Justice.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to that part of the story here in a moment. But I have to say, I wonder, and I'm not going to ask you to make an assessment about William Rehnquist's motivations necessarily, but there is the question of whether or not what his opposition to voting rights, you know, the Voting Rights Act, what it was this ideological, or was it just, you know, craven racism? What do you make of William Rehnquist, and not just that, but how this becomes so political, so ideological in modern American politics?
Probably some of both. I mean, Barry Goldwater and William Rehnquist and others were running on states' rights. Yeah. They believed that states, not the federal government, should set qualifications for voting and other things. But you also have to remember that that led to very racist outcomes. I mean, states' rights is what the likes of George Wallace had used for many, many years to oppose things like the Voting Rights Act. So when you talked about states' rights and things like that, everyone knew that those were code words to opposing things like voting rights, things like civil rights for African Americans. So Rehnquist very well could have had a principled ideology, but that principled ideology led to some very racist actions, both in terms of actual actions, like giving literacy tests to Black and Latino voters, but a whole ideology that would then begin to roll back those rights for those previously disenfranchised and marginalized groups. And that ideology basically became the core Republican judicial philosophy that is so dominant now. And basically what happened is Rehnquist and others embraced this idea of colorblindness, that any consideration of race in public policy to try to address historical racism and disenfranchisement was in and of itself racist and unconstitutional. And that basically laid the groundwork for people like John Roberts to oppose things like the Voting Rights Act and say, we're not racist. We just believe in colorblindness. But of course, that gets you to the same place at the end of the day.
Yeah. You mentioned in the film that the election of Barack Obama is really seized upon by people of that sense of ideology who are critics of the Voting Rights Act. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. Let's talk about Shelby County versus Holder, this case. Maybe take a moment, if you wouldn't mind, Ari Berman, to sort of lay out the case for us, because this is a really critical moment that brings us to this big question. Has the Voting Rights Act, is it relevant still today? We don't have a Jim Crow South anymore. And that was the argument, the ideological argument being made against the Voting Rights Act, that it served its purpose for its time, but it's not really relevant today.
Exactly. Right after Barack Obama's election, you start hearing from critics of the Voting Rights Act that the Voting Rights Act is no longer necessary, that if someone like Barack Obama can be elected president, the country can't be as fundamentally racist as it was in the 1960s. And therefore, parts of the Voting Rights Act are no longer needed. And there's a challenge from Shelby County, Alabama, which is outside of Birmingham. And basically, it's one of those places that needs to get approval for its voting changes. That was one key part of the Voting Rights Act, that if a state like Alabama with a history of discrimination wanted to make a change to their voting procedures, they had to get it approved with the federal government to make sure that it wasn't discriminatory, because Lyndon Johnson and the Congress knew very well that once you struck down a poll tax or literacy test in Alabama, they were just going to try to pass another one. So you tried to shift the burden of discrimination from those facing discrimination to those doing the discriminating. And this county in Alabama successfully challenges the Voting Rights Act, and John Roberts writes a 5-4 opinion gutting the act, ruling that states with a long history of discrimination no longer need to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And basically, Roberts says that the country has changed dramatically since 1965, that blatant voter suppression is a thing of the past, but that the Voting Rights Act continues to treat the South in particular as if nothing has changed, and that the Voting Rights Act needs to be justified by current obstacles to voting, not past ones. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg gives this famous dissent in which she says, you don't throw away your umbrella just because you're not getting wet one day, that it's going to rain in the future. And of course, she was prescient, because we've seen just a whole raft of laws making it harder for people of color to vote in states with a long history of discrimination since Roberts said that racism was basically a thing of the past.
What are some of those efforts? Not so long ago, you published a comprehensive list of some of these efforts to suppress the vote. Could you just go through a few of these? I mean, there's like 29, but so we don't have time to get to all of them. But just maybe mention some of the ones that you think are particularly problematic.
So there's both longstanding restrictions on voting, things like the fact that states with a long history of discrimination have closed over 1,600 polling places since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. Then there's new things because of the pandemic. There's all these fights about mail voting. So the Trump campaign is litigating to say states shouldn't be able to send ballots to all registered voters, like, for example, Republican-led Utah has been doing for years. Or states shouldn't be able to send absentee ballot requests to voters. Or you should be able to get a witness signature on your ballot even at a time of social distancing. Or there shouldn't be drop boxes for mail voting. Or ballots should be rejected for mismatched signatures. All of these things that no one had really ever thought about, because in most states, people didn't vote by mail in large numbers, are now being aggressively litigated across the country. We saw over 500,000 mail ballots rejected during the primaries, which was a huge increase from 2016. And it really sets up a very chaotic election day where people are extremely concerned about, number one, how they should vote, and number two, how their vote should be counted. And I think this is a debate that we're not having in Oregon or Washington or Utah, in states where people have used vote by mail, both parties, very successfully, and there's really not much debate about it. But in states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan, where it's new and the elections are close, when there's these fierce battles between Democrats and Republicans, all of this is very contentious. Not to mention, every single day, the president of the United States is pushing falsehoods about voting. I mean, voter suppression goes back a long way, right? We've been talking about it since the beginning of our country's history. People like John Roberts have a long history of promoting laws that make it harder to vote. John Roberts isn't lying about voter fraud every single day on Twitter like Donald Trump is. And so, I mean, Trump has just brought a whole new dimension to voter suppression, that he's both been so open about the fact that he wants to defund the post office and do some things like that, try to hurt the ability of people, particularly Democrats, to vote. But also, he just promoted so many falsehoods about voting. There was a huge study from Harvard that found that Donald Trump and Fox News were the biggest spreaders of disinformation about voting, more than Russia, more than China, that the president of the United States and his allies were the number one spreader of disinformation in this country. And so that's a really new thing that we're facing here, and a really chilling one as we're just weeks before November 3rd.
So disinformation, that's something you have written about, some of the efforts that to just basically misinform people. One of them, I wanted to come back to voter fraud and ask, the Heritage Foundation, for example, is included in the film, and they say, we have a sampling of these proven voter fraud cases. They say they have up to 1,300 cases. So you put those numbers in perspective for us and what you make of just the assertion of voter fraud.
Well, voter fraud is an exceedingly small problem in American elections. It happens from time to time, but it is not nearly as common as some people are alleging. Usually when it happens in large enough numbers to swing an election, like it did in North Carolina in 2018, you can tell, it's obvious there's been some manipulation. The more votes you have to fraudulently switch, the easier it is to actually uncover it. And even the Heritage Foundation, when it comes to mail voting, they've only found 143 criminal convictions for mail ballot fraud over the past 20 years, which equals out to 0.0006% of total votes cast. So if you actually talk to experts on voting, not politicians, but experts on voting, whether they be Republican secretaries of state, or there were a series of columns in the Washington Post by former GOP elections lawyer Ben Ginsburg, who was the top Republican voting lawyer for decades, they basically say voter fraud is not unheard of, but it's exceedingly rare. And it's much, much, much less common than Donald Trump says it is. And every single evidence, every single piece of information that Donald Trump has trotted out, whether it's 2.9 million people voting illegally in California, or mail ballots being forged in huge numbers in other states, or truckloads of ballots, trucks picking up mail ballots, or all of it has been debunked and disproven. Some of it is just so insane, you can't even really believe it. But the unfortunate thing is that millions and millions of people do believe it. And now this is a debate rather than a fact. We are now debating whether or not voter fraud exists, when we know from all the studies that it exists in very, very small numbers.
Let me ask you about another bit of disinformation you say is being employed, and that is setting harmful expectations of a quick result. What's this about?
Well, President Trump has basically said that only Election Day votes should count.
Yeah.
And that either mail ballots shouldn't count at all, which is insane and would come to as a shock to all the Republicans in Utah that are going to vote by mail in this election. But also he's basically saying that whatever the results are on election night, that should be the official tally. And that's not how it works. A number of states have extended the deadlines for voting because of the pandemic and because of delays at the post office, so that if your ballot is postmarked by Election Day, it can count after. What Trump is basically thinking is that if all his people decide to vote in person on Election Day or beforehand, their votes will be counted quicker than those mail ballots that arrive later or take longer to count. And therefore, it will seem like he's up on Election Day, but in fact, in the coming days, it'll show that Democrats are doing better. That's what happened, for example, with Arizona Senate election, where Kyrsten Sinema was losing on election night, but actually won the election pretty handily in the end a few weeks after. And so Trump is basically setting up a situation where he's going to say all of the votes cast after Election Day are illegitimate and shouldn't be counted. And of course, those are the votes that favor Democrats. Now, I should say, we don't know if that's actually going to happen. Yeah. It may very well be that Joe Biden wins enough of a landslide that we will know who the president is on election night or a few days after. It's also true that Trump doesn't have the power to unilaterally declare himself the winner of the election, that votes are counted at the state and local level, and that states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania are not going to release results until they know who the winner is, until all those votes are counted. And Trump doesn't have the power to declare those votes invalid. But there's going to be a giant disinformation campaign coming from the president and his supporters if he's up on election night and then his lead slips or evaporates in the days later. And it's going to take a lot from the media and other trusted institutions in society to point out how elections actually work and to say what the president is saying is not true. And that's going to be a really tough moment for American democracy.
You've been writing lately about some of the efforts by the Trump campaign and other Republican allies to take these steps, you say, to undermine fair elections. What are some of the attempts that you're seeing? What is the effort like, as far as you can tell?
Well, there's all sorts of things. There's litigating all aspects of voting, making it harder to vote by mail, making it harder to vote in person. So that there's very, very long lines, spreading lies and disinformation. So people feel like their votes don't count, recruiting people to challenge the eligibility of people at the polls, casting doubt on the ability of the post office, for example, these very trusted institutions, to be able to deliver the mail and deliver ballots on time. I mean, there's so many different tactics. That's why.
What did you make of the – I just – sorry to step in, but what did you make of Donald Trump in the presidential debate saying – asking voters to basically be observers at, you know, polling places?
Well, it's pretty chilling. I mean, Republicans for many years were prohibited from doing the kind of ballot security operations that we talked about William Rehnquist doing. They did that in the 1980s in New Jersey. They put off-duty police officers at a heavily Black and Latino voting precincts in New Jersey, in cities like Trenton and Newark. And they were banned from doing that because it was ruled to be voter intimidation. And they were freed from that that court decision, that consent decree that lasted basically 30 years. And so they can do that kind of poll watching to some extent this election. But Trump, I think, was telling people to go far beyond that, because the Republican poll watchers, if they're official, they still have to register with their election officials. They still have to be trained. They still have to go through a process. I'm not so concerned about those people. What I'm concerned about are the vigilantes, the Proud Boys types, the militia types that tried to kidnap the governor of Michigan, kidnap the governor of Virginia. Are they going to start showing up at the polls? And what's going to happen if that's the case? What's going to happen if white supremacists go into downtown Philadelphia and try to intimidate Black voters? I mean, that is a very volatile situation right now. It's a volatile situation anytime, but it's a particularly volatile situation at this day and age. So I think Trump is creating a situation where he's essentially calling for armed vigilantes to ally with his campaign, which is really, really chilling. And I think he's also just trying to suppress the vote by even talking about it, that he's trying to make the vote seem scary or dangerous so that Democrats don't even show up at all. And I just want people to know that if you're online and if you're eligible to vote, you have a right to vote. And if that happens to you, you should call election protection. You should call 866-OUR-VOTE. You should let local election officials know that this kind of thing is illegal, that voter intimidation is a crime, and that people don't have the right to just go up to people and challenge your eligibility to vote.
Ari Berman, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ari Berman, he's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He's featured in the documentary All In, the Fight for Democracy, which you can see for free on our online screening Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. This is part of our monthly film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get more details by going to our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.